Hello, everybody. Today is February 7th, 2023, and this is a journey through history. Today, we are discussing the book Mao's Last Dancer. I know those are the first three words. I think it goes on for a bunch more words, but those are only three I know. And I apologize. I can't remember who the author is, but I'm sure we'll know as we get the recordings played and stuff like that. But anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Brad, who I know he's got the recording ready to go, and we can all hear what we can hear. So thanks for coming.
All right. We got the recording. It is a little longer than usual, 38 minutes, but wow. Don said there's good stuff in it. So that's why it's so long. So I'm going to mute everybody, and then we're going to get it going. So
thank you.
Here goes the muting.
It's the way he interprets a part. His athleticism and technical perfection that makes him one of the finest dancers in the world today. Lee's a huge star in the United States. He's won hearts everywhere.
Can a great dancer be trained, or do they have to be born that way?
I think you have to have both. You have to have some talent, but I think at the end of the day that might only be accounting for 20 or 30% of your success. The rest, the 80 or 70% of that is hard work, is have a great work ethic, have determination, and just really work your butt off to really achieve what you want to achieve.
Do you think you always had the gift of dance in you, or is it something that you found?
Well, I came from a poor peasant background, poverty stricken, and at any given day the tree barks in my village were all being eaten, so my parents were never educated, so my entire life never had any arts or culture. So that dance or ballet came to me as an utter surprise to me or to my family.
Yeah, when you mention poverty stricken, I don't think everyone grasps how low down that is. Explain a little bit about what your life was like.
I was born into a peasant family. I was the sixth of seven sons. My parents did not go to school for a single day, so they couldn't read or write. But there were about 30 million people died of starvation in China a few years before I was born. So there was no running water, there was no heating, and at the winter time, my hometown, the temperature could drop down to as low as 20 degrees below zero, and it's freezing. So, and there's only a few hours of electricity each night. So utterly, life was incredible. Every time when my mother served the meal for the family, for the entire family, we would look at the meal that served, then we would look at our mother with desperate begging, wanting to know if there's any food, because before we even started, just by look at, we knew we were going to go to sleep starving that night. The food that served was not going to be enough to eat for all of us.
Did you know there was a life outside of all that, though? Did you understand how other people in the world lived at the same time?
Well, we knew what the people around us lived in the same village, what their life was like, which was some people were even poorer than us. And one of my playmates, when I was about six or seven, happily played with me one day. The next day, he just died because he had ate something out of total starvation and had a terrible infection. There was no money for his parents to take him to the hospital, so he suddenly died about a week or so later. But we were told when we grew up by the Chinese propaganda that we lived in the most glorious, most prosperous life. Lucky, we were very lucky to be born under Mao's China. So our impression of the Western world was even much poorer. They lived in a much, much poorer life, and the sky was gray, they lived in the dark ages. So we grew up with that impression.
Yeah. When you went to school, what was school like?
I didn't go to school until when I was nine, because there's no classrooms available. This simple commune shack, no heating. That particular winter when I was selected to go to the Madam Miles Peking Dance Academy, just as when I was about turning 11. And that day was freezingly cold, snowing very, very hard. My mother had sewn this thick cotton quilted coat and pants. I looked like this round snowball reading I Love You, Chairman Mao text in this freezing cold room. Suddenly, four gentlemen walk out into the room, looking dignified the way they dressed, and was just not the ordinary people in my hometown. Suddenly, they were introduced to us as Madam Mao's cultural advisors from the Beijing Dance Academy to select talents to train as ballet dancers. But again, as I said earlier, we didn't know anything about ballet, and we were asked to stand up to sing I Love You, Chairman Mao songs. As we sang, these four gentlemen walk along the aisles, look at each person's faces. There were about over 40 of us. They passed me by without taking any notice. They selected one girl out of the 40-odd kids. Just as when they were about to walk out of the room, my teacher hesitated and eventually tapped on the shoulder for the very last gentleman. Just as he was about to walk out the door, she said, "Excuse me, sir, what about that one?" And that one was me. Just years later, when I tracked her down, I said, "Teacher, son, please tell me, why did you single me out that day? For what reason?" She said, "For years, Lee, I wondered. I still don't really know why I point you out that day. But all I thought at that moment was you ran fast." I ran fast in my sports classes. And that was the sole reason she pointed me out. But then suddenly I was put into, led into this room, which is the only room in the school had the little heater. It's the head of the school's office. We were torn. They take all our clothes off. They measured us inch by inch of our bodies. There were about 10 of us there from all different classes selected there. And suddenly I was pushed against the wall. One person held one of my knees straight. The other person pushed both my shoulders firmly against the wall, so I could not move a single inch. The third person lifted the other leg high up in the air. As he lifted, he kept on asking me, "Does it hurt?" And it was excruciating. They have torn both of my hamstrings that day. But stubbornly, I knew deep inside of me that was my one and only chance that I have dreamed about to get out of that vicious life.
I'm sure you've thought about and wondered, what if you hadn't been chosen, what your life would have been? Any idea how it would have gone from looking at your family or other people in the village?
Oh, I would have been a peasant working in the field for the rest of my life. And from that moment onwards, I wanted desperately to escape the fate I was born into. And I wanted to do something special with my life. And maybe then I could have come back to help my family.
So you're 11 years old, just chosen to go to the academy. What happens? Are you taken away from your family? What's the relationship?
I was terribly homesick. We were not allowed to visit our families until the end of the year. So once a year we were allowed. I was really sobbing myself to sleep at night, clutching onto my mother's quilt. And I did not want other people to discover my tears. So I covered myself at nighttime just for quite many times during these first 2 years. Our training was brutal at the Peking Dance Academy. We got up at 5:30 in the morning, went all the way to 9 o'clock at night, 6 days a week. And the training was utterly brutal. And it was this incredible Russian training, but we were shouted at. And it was an incredible life. And taught me discipline, taught me determination. Once I fell in love with ballet, I strapped sandbags on both of my legs, hopped up and down on one leg on four flights of stairs at 5 o'clock in the morning to train my jumping ability. And I would sneak away at nighttime, light this little candle in the dark studio, endlessly practice my turns so I would not be discovered. I can't turn the light on because then otherwise I would be, you know, have to go back to bed again. So I was endlessly trying to, you know, practice my spotting in my turns. I felt if I could turn in a dark light, I could turn with lights on stage.
What was it about ballet, though, that spoke to you? Was it the love of the art form, or was it the escape that it promised you?
At first, I thought I was lucky to get a bowl of rice for the first time in my life, have enough food to eat when I was at the Peking Dance Academy. And then eventually, through this wonderful teacher who was my mentor, who discovered me at the end of my second year at the Beijing Dance Academy, he loved ballet with passion. And he, one of his missions was he felt I was talented, and he wanted me to look at ballet through his eyes. And that did it for me. And he guided me, he nurtured me, he encouraged me to really get into the process of loving that ballet. And eventually, I loved ballet with passion. I realized how beautiful this art form truly is, and the music, just maybe it's music, because I was starved of music for the rest of my life. So when I first heard a beautiful piece of music played with this wonderful piano, and I just thought, my God, you know, this was heaven. And yeah. So that music combined with the graceful movements of the dance took my heart away. So from that moment onward, I worked probably harder than anybody at the Peking Dance Academy. And in the end, from a hopeless dance in ballet student, became one of the top in China.
When they talk about things like this, you often hear people say survivor guilt. Was there any part of you that felt guilty that you were getting this life, that you had your bowl of rice and your family didn't? Was there a part that ever was difficult to deal with?
For all these 7 years when I was at the Peking Dance Academy, every time I had a bowl of rice, every time I had a fruit, I had an apple or banana, I cannot stop myself from thinking, I wish I could give this bowl of rice or half the bowl of rice or this fruit to my mother. I knew they were still starving back home. Only if I could kept it for them, I would have done it. And it was just, and years later when I came to America, that was the same way. I never took life for granted. I treasured everything, all the beautiful things life had to offer, and I really constantly tried to remember what it was like back in China. And I could never forget that. So when I had the very first opportunity to send money home to my family, to my parents, to my brothers, I did. Yeah. And I'm still doing that today.
There was a point where you came to this country, you got invited here for school to learn more dance here. How did that come about?
Amazing. It's an amazing opportunity, sort of almost by fate, just like the day I was selected to study ballet and the day I was discovered by this teacher in Beijing. And in 1979, I was discovered by Ben Stevenson, who was the artistic director of the Houston Ballet and now the artistic director of the Texas Ballet Theater in Dallas-Fort Worth. And he went to China with the very first cultural delegation from America to China. That was in 1979, and there he taught a couple of master classes. He discovered me, offered 2 scholarships to come to study at the Houston Ballet Academy summer school that year.
Why? Let me stop you there and just ask, why did the government allow that?
Well, Deng Xiaoping had took over power a couple of years before that. So China had just started to gradually open up. But when Ben Stevenson gave the invitation, they didn't think anything about it. They didn't think that was going to happen at all. But very quickly, they got a phone call from Deng Xiaoping's office. Says, have you done anything with these 2 scholarships? They didn't know then George Bush Sr. was actually the first ambassador to China, but Barbara Bush was on the board of the Houston Ballet. So it was that connection we actually likely got to America. And we didn't speak a word of English. It was just everything was, you know, lost. We were totally lost, almost like in space.
You tell a great story about going out to dinner when you first got here.
That's right. We were taken to this wonderful Chinese restaurant in Houston for the very first time in my life. I had Peking duck. And the night, the food was just kept coming on. It was the most delicious food we ever had. But of course, we were told by the Chinese officials that when people speak to you or ask you questions, if you did not understand, you should never say the word no. You should always smile, nod your head, say yes. By the end of the evening, we were just utterly stuffed. We were so full. Of course, still, my director kept asking us, he said, are you still hungry? We didn't understand a word he said, so we smiled, nodded our heads, said yes.
So you kept eating and you enjoyed that, huh?
It was wonderful. I mean, you know, what actually, even though we had this incredible food, but what I found was so disturbing was the amount of waste.
Yeah.
That night, there was so much food left on that table, and it just broke my heart. I just thought, only if I could put it all into a doggy box and take it back.
What must you have thought, though, of this land when you came here, from what you'd come from before, from what you'd been taught about what you'd find here?
It was a total culture shock. What we saw did not fit into what we were taught for the first 18 years of my life. It just did not fit. Yeah. And at first, I thought, well, you know, the streets are clean. I thought they could really sweep the streets to impress us, these two Chinese communists coming. But they cannot simply build these huge high-rise buildings, these enormous highways, just to impress us. And when people give us flowers and cowboy hats when we first arrived in the Houston airport, I just thought, should we take it or should we not? Should we refuse it? Because we thought there must be some hidden agenda behind those smiling faces, behind this cowboy hat and the flowers, because we did not trust the American people.
When did you come to trust? There had to be some trust before you were going to do what you did next.
That realization came to me gradually. But as a young Communist Youth Party leader, which I was, and that realization was devastating, because that means 18 years of my learning, of my beliefs, had all crumbled right in front of me. I felt like there was a carpet or the floor have taken away from me and just right underneath me. So what do I need to believe? Right. And it was a really, really enlightening moment, but it's a devastating moment at the same time.
Yeah. And then you decide, through, I guess, a series of events, to stay in this country.
That's right.
How did that come about?
Well, I fell in love with this beautiful young American girl who was also a student at the Houston Ballet Academy. And she was my first love, which was just so beautiful. And for the very first time in my life, I felt I could love somebody freely and being loved freely. Which back in China, if I fell in love with somebody, I have to truly go to my political advisor and say, may I talk about my feelings to that girl? And I was not allowed to go directly to that girl to express my feelings. So by having that love, and it was incredible. So I married her, and I went into the Chinese consulate in Houston to explain my marriage. And they were supposed to let me go in a few minutes. We'll be on our honeymoon. And finally, suddenly, I was dragged away by four guards and locked up at the consulate for 21 hours in this dark room. Was interrogated. I was threatened for my life, but also I was so worried my parents and my family in China, back in China, was going to be in trouble.
Well, let me understand this. If you got married, did you assume then you'd be able to stay in this country, or were you still responsible to go back?
My intention was to go back to China with my wife, to live in China, dance in China for half a year, and be able to come back to the West to dance for half a year. But the Chinese consulate official, I think they felt personally responsible for what I did, and they were really scared they were going to get the blame. So mm-hmm. they did not want to hear any of that. They said, no, we decide your fate, we decide your life, what are you going to do? You are not going to marry that person without our blessing, which had that direct conflict with what, you know, the Western in society and the rights of, you know, human rights was all about.
Right.
So you know, eventually I was released unharmed, and apparently the FBI had surrounded the consulate for at that time, which I didn't know then, and Vice President George Bush was involved because Barbara Bush was still on the board of the Houston Ballet. By that point, I got to know them quite well. And then eventually the Chinese government, the top Chinese government says, release him. And the funny thing was the Chinese consulate had all, in Houston, had all unplugged all the telephone calls. By the time they discovered this lawyer, Charles Foster, had been making phone calls to the State Department, to the federal judge and all that. And there was a federal judge court martial ordered for them to produce me at the court the next day. So there was a huge amount of pressure from the legal side and from the political, the government side of it. So eventually, and I was released. And I was amazed. I walked out of that consulate alive.
Yeah.
And it was the darkest 24 hours of my life. And the worst of all, the thought of never be able to see my beloved mother, father, my brothers and friends back in China was just unbearable.
When you walked out, when you were free in a sense, what was your understanding of what your relationship would be allowed to be with your family back home?
I never thought I would ever see them again. And in fact, I did not see them for 5 long years. And those 5 long years, the sadness, the tears had virtually nearly, suffocated me. Yeah. Eventually, I discovered they were not implicated at all.
Really?
Which was just amazing.
Were they told of what was going on? Did they know the struggle you were going through?
A few Chinese officials paid a visit to my parents a few days after my defection, and they were basically accused my parents for have such a bastard of son. And my mother turned around to them and says, you took my son away at age 11. You were responsible for his upbringing, for his education. Now you have lost my son. I want him back. And she was heartbreaking because she did not know whether her son was still alive or dead. So for her, she felt she had lost her son, her sixth son, forever. But also the struggle to be the best in the dance world and to do the utter best to become one of the top dancers in the world, coming from being a Chinese, ballet is not something natural. It's not the Peking opera. And, it's a Western art form. So for me to be recognized to be one of the world's top dancers, it was not easy. Yeah. I put a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication into it.
When you look back on your life, which I guess you had to do recently when you wrote all of this in the book, and you look back on your life, do you realize that's the same person? Do you feel a connection, or does that seem like just a story you know now?
Well, I was amazed when I was writing my autobiography to reflect upon my journey. I was amazed that that was all me.
Yeah.
And sometimes I still think, did that really happen to me? Did I really got out of the Chinese consulate alive? Was I really allowed to see my parents? And I still remember that day when they came to see me performing ballet for the very first time ever. And the airplane was late to arrive in Houston. And the people, friends, picked them up from the airport, rushed them through the Houston traffic with the police escort over to the theater directly. And they held the curtain for 20 minutes. We were doing the opening night of Nutcracker. And by the time they walked in, the whole audience knew my parents were arriving from China to see me dance for the very first time. When they walked in, the whole audience started to applaud for them. And my poor mother just started sobbing from that moment onwards.
Yeah.
It was just really an emotional moment when they came back on stage during the intermission. The three of us looked at each other, just utterly speechless. We were just hugged in a pool of tears. And it was the most special moment in my entire life.
Well, it's funny you talk about your culture shock. I can't even imagine what it was like for your mother to all of a sudden be in the midst of all this, because her transformation happened immediately.
That's right.
That's
right. She had her first car ride, her first train ride, the first airplane ride, and walking into a Western theater for the very first time in her life. So it was just for them, the culture shock was even bigger.
Of course, his career then soared because he was their principal dancer.
Dance on the most prestigious stages, in front of the presidents, prime ministers, royalties, name it. And it was during that time, I danced with Mary. I was immediately taken by her artistry, by her beautiful dancing, beautiful musicality.
It was chemistry from the very beginning. Lee and I were married in Houston in 1987. We were two principal dancers at Houston Ballet, starting a new life together.
Mary and I, we always wanted children. And for Mary to come back to dance Korea, that was the plan.
In fact, she's not even 24 hours. Mm.
Sophie was born in Houston in 1989, and she was our first child. Sophie was such a beauty.
It just makes every day just really, really special. It really does. I still think that now. And I said to Lee the other night, I said, you know, every day is just such a blast. Happy, happy
day. I thought we had everything. I had a beautiful husband, beautiful baby. I had a career that my director was going to have me back. So I had more than I ever wanted.
You know, I love dancing with a passion, so I mean, nothing will change that. Not if I was 105 and, you know, it just, it's there. That's where my love is.
She's watching the TV. Fifi, come to daddy. Fifi! Mary, get her attention.
When Sophie was 17 months old, Lee and Sophie were out with a group of children, and Sophie was given a balloon.
And suddenly, Sophie's balloon popped. And it startled everyone. The only person had no reaction to it was Sophie. Sophie just simply just looking for her balloon and absolutely have no idea how loud that pop sound was. At that moment, my heart seemed just dropped. Sort of shock came through. I thought, she didn't react to the sound. I pulled Mary to the side. I said, Mary, something wrong here.
I kept saying, I'm sure she's fine. I'm sure she just... And he said, no. And so we had a hearing test and she was diagnosed profoundly deaf.
Mary actually coped with that news much better than I did. I was in shock. I was in absolute shock. The only thing that went through my mind was there had to be a cure. There had to be something we could do to fix it.
My parents had three options. They could do sign language, or they could do the old method, or do cue speech. Sign language wasn't an option because my dad's Chinese, my mum's Australian, and we were living in America, so that would meant learning three different languages. And then the medical professionals highly recommended all, which means to speak.
We made a conscious decision early on to really teach her verbally, because we really wanted her to be able to communicate to as many people as possible to the speaking world. And we were told early on that if she starts signing, she may not speak. It's like a lazy eye syndrome. So Mary, she quickly sprung to action and immediately start speech therapy and went on to get her fitted with hearing aids.
She's crying.
Oh, do you think she's crying?
I knew that time was of the essence. Basically, the language that you're supposed to get happens between 1 and 5. I needed to hear my daughter's voice, no question. I told Lee that I wouldn't be going back on the stage. And I said, I am stopping so I can teach my daughter to speak.
It was a heartbreaking experience for me to lose Mary as a partner, for her to give up something she loved so much from ever a little child.
My journey was hard and tough at times. My family didn't quite understand, and it almost like tore, you know, our relationship apart.
one day old.
Hi, Sophie.
Sophie, hello. It's your daddy.
I was born profoundly deaf and I have no hearing at all. Mum gave up her entire ballet career to give me the opportunities that other people in the hearing world have.
I've really only been driven by two things, and one was ballet and the second one was Sophie and my family and teaching her to speak, really. And I wanted her to be able to communicate with everybody.
When my parents set up that goal of having me hear and speak, they had no idea if this goal was going to be achievable or not. They just knew they wanted it. But it's not easy for a profoundly deaf person to be part of the hearing world. Listening when you're naturally not a hearing person is a lot of hard work. And for my mum, she didn't realise or she didn't quite understand why I had to go through that journey of embracing my deafness.
There's Sophie.
See how amazing it is that I'm talking.
I did my absolute best for Sophie, or for what I thought was at the time.
It was a huge struggle for me, for my parents.
I think the path that we took was possibly too hard, but we couldn't know that.
Upper back, darlings, that's it. Through first, beautiful first.
Mary has always been a fantastic teacher, coach. She's actually one of my best coaches.
Callum, use that plie.
I love my dancers because I did the same journey. So I know how tough it is, and I am tough, but I'm also kind. And often I think to myself, I taught a deaf child to speak, I can teach you anything.
Good, I go see the kite. There it is.
When Sophie was four, I heard about the cochlear implant through a therapist.
So the cochlear implant, which is also known as a bionic ear, is quite different to a hearing aid. So a hearing aid relies on the fact that you have some hearing. The cochlear implant means you have no hearing whatsoever. So they generate electrical signals to mimic sound for you. And so suddenly was quite overwhelming, and I didn't know what the sounds were or what they meant.
About a year or so after the implant, I think that was a breakthrough for Sophie. Mary started singing Rain Rain Go Away behind her, and then Mary stopped and Sophie carried on. And so that moment that Mary really realized that, you know, she actually can hear sound. It was an enormously exciting moment for us.
She did her first ballet exam and she came out with a very high mark. And so we thought that was marvellous because that wasn't language-based. So she was the same as everybody else.
After we moved to Queensland, just gradually Sophie and Mary start communicating less and less.
Around this time, I got a boyfriend who was deaf and he did not speak, he only signed. My parents started to hear a lot of deaf. And I think they became really quite concerned just how deaf my life was at that point. Would this mean I would decide to renounce the hearing world and go completely deaf myself and take off the cochlear implant and no longer communicate with them in the way that we both did?
Well, I didn't want to lose her to just the deaf world because I knew she could speak as well. And I didn't want her to reject the hearing world because it was too hard. And I was frightened for her because I didn't want her to close any options off. But Lee would always say, it's her choice. Things came to a head with Sophie and I when the Queensland Ballet supported a charity that used an auditory verbal approach, which is what I did with Sophie, to teach a child to speak through hearing, through implants.
We thought she would be excited, but she actually said, well, if it was me, I would make a different choice. And it was a lot more than an argument. But they were screaming at each other, and I can't even get a word in. And then Sophie basically slammed her implant on the tables and walked off. And the next morning, she left early and didn't say goodbye and just went to the airport, flew back to Melbourne.
I was just stunned, really. I had given up my life for her to speak, and I was very sad about that.
Mary was beside herself. She was so devastated and so angry, and I knew Sophie would be so angry too.
For a six-month period, the relationship between my mum became really strained and tense until I decided to write both my parents a letter.
Hey, Mum and Dad. Hope you guys are going well.
Really, I just wanted to reassure them that I was still their daughter and that I still love them. And I wanted to be really clear, I don't resent choices my parents made about them, because I knew they gave me a really valuable skill, which is to hear and speak. But what I did resent them was not giving me the access that I had needed. For, like, with deaf strategies, having deaf role models, I didn't have any of that, which is also just equally important.
Then I started to worry. Will my parents accept me for who I am now? Should I tell my parents I'm fluent in Auslan?
Both Mary and I read it, and we couldn't speak. We thought we knew our daughter so well. We knew what she was thinking. We knew what makes her happy, what makes her sad. We knew her struggles, but not nearly. Sophie was really suffering a great deal.
It was a confronting conversation to have, but it was a long time coming.
That was kind of the beginning of repairing our relationship. We started to sort of see things from her point of view.
A beautiful mother and a beautiful father, how lucky can you get? It's a great story to tell afterwards, though.
I was just sitting down after a day of work, and the parents came in and said, Sophie, we've just both realised it's not too late to learn Auslan. So when can we start? And then my brother started piping up saying, that, oh yeah, I'd like to join. And then my sister was like, oh yeah, me too, I want to learn as well. It was like a dream come true, the fact that they were able to meet with me in the middle. I don't ever expect them to become fluent, but like basic Auslan just makes my life so much easier. And it's hilarious watching them learn.
Oh, we have a lot of fun in these lessons. We laugh a lot and we make a fool of ourselves, but it's a lot of joy, a lot of laughter. I think it's going to be a work in progress for a little while, but we are definitely into it.
Your guidance, it's really become one of the preeminent ballet companies in the world, and I think it's a wonderful story. Could you tell us a little bit about the Queensland Ballet and the journey that you've been on with the ballet?
Sure. This is my ninth year. When I came in 2012, the company was relatively small. For example, the dancers didn't even have a decent dressing room stations. So I have to pull a few favors from my business contacts with Bunnings, for example, to ask them to donate simple mirror and lighting to fly our carpenter friend from Melbourne and to help the dancers building just decent dressing stations. So before the performance, they can have a mirror and light to work with to make up rather than keep running the bathroom and all pushing each other out of the way to get to the mirror. A few statistics. When I came, our company was around $5 million annual. And before COVID, our budget was $28 million. And we come from 23 dancers when I first came. Now we are 60. Yeah. And we are invited to perform around the world now. And our audience numbers were just absolutely has, you know, expanded tremendously.
think that's it, folks.
Don, you want to say anything at the beginning, or you want me to start rolling? How you want to do it?
Hey, to unmute, Don. Take it, Alan.
All right, I'll just start calling on folks and hope Don pipes in. So I'm just going to go down the list and ask folks if they read the book, if they have any comments about the book, and like we usually do. So that was a long recording. Let's see. Brad, you're at the top. Did you read the book or not?
No, I did not. I was catching up on some other reading this month.
I understand. That's perfectly great. Okay, so let's see. David Fauché, how about you?
Yes, I read the book. It's been a while. Heat Garden Gould was one of my favorite narrators. This book was a unique story. I cannot imagine the tenacity and the endurance this guy had. I mean, I went away to a school for the blind, and we would stay 2 weeks at a time. I cannot imagine being away for a year at a time. That sounds mind-boggling. It really does. I like Don's collection of interviews. I didn't think he was going to find as much because this book came out in 2003, but apparently there's a lot out there. I had a question, though, for anyone in the group. Did he say he helped his parents? I wonder what happened to his parents when he became famous. I kind of wonder what happened with his family because the book ends back then.
You know, I mean, it has a couple of references to where he goes back and visits them.
They came and visited him and then stayed a year.
Okay.
One time.
Yeah, and he was able to visit them some. And
That was all in the book, right? Because it's been a while since I've read
it. I thought it was 6 months, that they could stay 6 months. But it doesn't matter. But yes, they would come.
What a culture shock.
And when he went back, definitely. He was amazed at even how the children were playing with a little more modern toys, electronic toys from Japan and stuff. So their situation changed quite a lot.
Yeah, he's seen the transformation of China. China has, love them or hate the country, they have gone through a staggering amount of stuff in a very short time.
Yeah, they really have.
Right. And what he wrote in the book about the Cultural Revolution is exactly what I have read in lots of books. There's lots of Chinese authors that have come over, you know, to the United States and written books about going through the Cultural Revolution. And boy, I thought his description was just dead on to what other people have said in their books.
David, was that it for you? You done?
I'll end by, it's interesting to hear a Chinese person with an Australian accent.
I was thinking the same thing,
Multicultural. Yeah. I mean, the wife's Australian, he's Chinese Australian, and his daughter is half Chinese, half Australian, and navigates the deaf culture. And that thing with the cochlear implant, my sister's a sign language interpreter. That is a touchy issue with deaf people.
I can imagine. Okay, thanks. Let's see.
Sure.
Don, I mean, you want to say a few words? It looks like you're unmuted now. Donald Queen. All right. Jana.
I did read this book. I thought it was very fascinating. And it was just intriguing to read about his, about the propaganda and how he at first loved Chairman Mao so much and the changes that he went through when he came to this country. And it was just a really good book. He was just such a hard worker and loved his family so much throughout the whole thing. And I don't really have anything too much to say. I really enjoyed the book and thank you for recommending it.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, Kathy Snyder, do you have more comments?
Well, I enjoyed the book a lot too, and I thought it was fascinating. I mean, here I grew up in Texas, never heard of this guy, never heard of the thing at the embassy. But what was also interesting is the interview or whatever about his daughter, and they wanted her to not sign and to talk and have the cochlear implant. And I thought, wow, that is so, you just think, I don't know, you think other people's lives are perfect, and here they had this big conflict. So anyway, yeah. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Betsy Grinovich. Oh, you're muted. Do you want to say anything? Unmute and speak. Okay. Lynn Evans, do you have any comments? Okay, I guess.
Okay, this is Lynn. I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I definitely like the book. It kind of dragged on quite a bit. But the first part I liked because he was telling his stories about his parents and stuff and their marriage and how they got married. And it's just to be brief about the whole thing. Just figured maybe the subtitle for the book should have been, subtitle for the title would be like Culture Shock, because it just kind of floored me about the poverty that he went through. And it was definitely a good read for me. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay. I'm unmuted now, Alan. For some reason, I had to push got it twice. I did it earlier, and then they required it again.
Okay, Betsy, go ahead. You're up.
I have not finished the book yet. I hope to finish it this week, but I've loved it. He's the same age as me, so I could relate to a lot of, just because we were the same age. And it was just really neat to hear, because I know even in the States, foster children go through similar things that he did. And I grew up in a foster home, and I knew that the boys could not use the indoor bathroom. They had a toilet to go to outside. So my life wasn't as bad as his, but there were some things that were similar. And I can't wait to finish it.
Excellent.
And it was neat on to hear him interview. So I wondered what he would sound like, because I know Chinese people. And
totally yeah, I agree with David. It's kind of funny to hear somebody that's a native Chinese with a little bit of an Australian
yes,
accent.
Yes, it was different, but it was neat to hear his voice. Nobody sounded
really,
like.
Really nice. Okay. Thank you so much. LaDon.
Yes, I read that book. I thought it didn't read like a novel, but it kept your interest like a novel. You know, all the pages were interesting. One of the things that interested me most was when they were little children, they had cricket fights. I said, cricket fights? You know, like rooster fights? I never heard of cricket fighting. That was amazing that they had crickets. And when he went home, his brother had saved him a cricket and said, here, this is a champion cricket, has won all these battles and everything, and then he was dead. But I thought that was really interesting, cricket fights. And then when he went to the consulate after he was married to stay here, I thought, how foolish are you going to the consulate? You know, he could have been ended up in another country's consulate and ended up killed and sawed apart with a saw. And so I didn't know when he got out of that. I guess it was because so many reporters and the vice president was interested in him. That's the only reason he didn't disappear right back into China. But I thought it was a well-written book, interesting throughout, and had some very... My doctor must have grown up after the Cultural Revolution, because he's Chinese, and my cancer doctor, and he goes back to China every year, you know, to visit his family. So I guess a lot of good things from their point of view, not like we would like, but a lot of good things have taken place in China now.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Well, I'll make a few comments, and then I'll see if Don has anything to say. I enjoyed the book too. I thought it was really good, because I really enjoyed learning about how he grew up and stuff, because I had no clue that, you know, as it happens, you know, in America we hear all this stuff, and it's hard to get a real feel for what it's like in another world. But when you read somebody that actually grew up like that, how poor they were, and the fact that the Gang of Four and Mao, it just must have been horrible, because that, you know, they're telling everybody that, you know, you're living the life, baby. You know, the rest of the world is, you know, a lot worse than this. I mean, how can you sell that when the people are eating dried sweet potatoes every day and starving to death? But I thought it was very, very enlightening to learn how he grew up. And in the interview, I thought, you know, when they were talking at the beginning, the guy was interviewing him and asking him about how important that, you know, like the natural athleticism is versus, you're never going to convince me. I think this, you know, your spirit and your will and your determination makes 90% of the people are the greatest athletes, because I mean, there's lots of people that have physical talent, but if you don't have that drive and that will, which he obviously had in spades, you're not going to rise to the top, because it's just too much.
But Alan, don't you think you need? He downplayed the talent part, and I think he went too low on that. 20.
Absolutely. I mean, the great ones have a natural ability too.
The Asians are really tenacious. They'll do something if it takes 10 years. They don't care.
Well, I mean, I think
he low-rated the talent a little bit.
I'm sure he probably did.
About spirit, because if you don't have it, all the talent in the world won't get you there.
I can't imagine being sent to Beijing when he was 11. You know,
that must have been scary.
He was real close to his family and stuff. They were obviously real tight growing up and stuff. I can only imagine how homesick he must have been those first 2 years. It was just horrible. And the other thing that I noted, that I'm always amazed by, what is it with people and lighter skin tones? I mean, even over in China, you know, the people all comment when he got back home, "Oh, your skin's lighter. You've been eating better," and they thought better of him because it's, you know, I'm always amazed by that. But it's just a reality. I don't know why that is, but it's
India too. India too is that way. They take women take bleaching cream in India.
Oh yeah, it always amazes me. But hey. What are you going to say? But I thought it was a good read. I didn't have any problem. It did read a little bit like a novel and stuff, because he just did a good job putting it all out there and laying the story out and stuff. But anyway, thanks. Well,
I read another book. I don't recall the name of it, but it was about Mao's last dancer female. And
the wife?
I don't know. No, it wasn't his wife. She was a dancer, just like he was, and was picked out to dance and so forth. But that was a novel.
Was it on board too?
Yes, it was. I cannot remember it. I cannot remember. I read it last year, and but it was she danced like he did, and then Mao come and picked her as one of his women for a while, and she finally escaped out of the. But anyhow, it's been a long time.
But it was a novel though, right?
It was a novel. And it was a woman, and she was the last female dancer or something like that. But it was very similar in talking about their upgrowing and their family. She was separated from her family. He got to go back after a year, but in the book novel, she didn't.
It might have been called Forbidden City, but I can't be sure.
It might have been.
Okay.
Well, that's what happened to the children over there. They would, these officials would go to the villages or the schools, and they would pick out children, and they would get sent to whatever athletic training or whatever, dancing or music. They would just get picked. And then, you know, over here, if you have talent as a child, if your parents nurture that and your coaches nurture that through schools, then
you were on.
There they were.
Any questions are
chosen and sent to these schools. And that's very much like it was. And he had some pictures in the book of his home and his village and stuff. It was very much very interesting, very like what you would think old school old Chinese, I don't know, landscape or whatever you would say. But every book I've ever read about any of the Chinese people coming out of China that lived through the Cultural Revolution, they were always picked. not necessarily any talent, just the officials came to their school. And it's still somewhat that way. In China, it's a very closed society. You don't pick the job you work at. You don't, you can't quit your job unless you have permission from the party. So it's still quite, and then if your parents are, even now, if they've protested and gotten caught or whatever, you may not be allowed to go to a university. So,
yeah, you have a social ID score thing, and I think Don wants to tell us on next.
Next. I hear that, and we really don't know what goes in China. I have a Chinese doctor, a cancer doctor, and he, you know, he goes back to China every year. So you wonder about all of that. Not exactly what we've been told. So about next month's book.
Yeah. Don, do you want to say something now?
Well, I was just going to tell you about the next book. I was going to say we had to leave some things out there, but there was two books in that about the thing, but it was a very good story. Okay. Are we ready for the next thing here?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. On Tuesday, March 7th, we will be reviewing the Face Makers, visionary surgeons battle to end the discarded soldiers from World War I. So, by Lindsay Harris, DB108939. His reading time is about 8 hours and 20 minutes. That's Lindsay, FITZHARRIS, and it's 108939. And she, it's about a doctor who is a graduate of Cambridge, but he's from New Zealand, of all things. And he went through the front, came back, and founded this hospital that dealt nothing with facial injury. And he's a lot of individual stories.
That sounds like it could be a tough read.
It does.
Yeah.
And then I'll give you my book at the end of March. It also relates to World War One, and Don and I did not plan it that way. It just happened.
Well, so is nobody has anything to say about Chinese spy balloons or not?
That was weird. That
we hadn't heard enough about that.
That story's still up in the air.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, all right. Well, I've got nothing else, and I don't know if Don does, but thanks everybody for coming.
Sorry about the computer problem.
No, that's all right. I mean, you were able to speak. We got to hear you. That's important. And the recordings were great as always. So thank you so much. And this was a good book, and you know, and I think we probably all learned a lot about China. Yeah. So, but I think it's good to be read about other cultures and stuff. So, but anyway, thanks everybody for your comments and for coming. So. Okay. Thank you, Brad. Thanks, Brad, for always doing such a great job playing the stuff. Well, it's great. Always, much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Yeah. We appreciate it. Okay. Y'all take care.
Good night.
We're done. Night. I'll end it. Good night, everybody.
Good night.